Tell me again, about the play that you're working on?
This is 17 years. There's a chapter in the book about the long pursuit with Anthony Quinn, who's been wanting to be Hemingway all these years. He's finally puts me into writing a play for him. It's kind of a strange but interesting play we got. There's only three characters, but the one actress plays all the women in his life. So we just had a reading of it at his place at the Adams Hotel with Lee Taylor Young reading the woman. And a good young actor reading the other character is the three men all played by the same guy. And it was rather interesting. And who knows, he says he's leaving Zorba in July and that he will do this in the fall. It only took 18 years to do it, that's all.
Gee, I thought you'd have Steiger doing Hemingway.
Yeah, my favorite character.
Have you ever healed?
Number one ingrate, no.
Never?
No.
Don't exchange cards or birthday cards?
We exchange deadly looks when we see each other, that's about it.
Well, I noticed the photograph of Steiger in there shows him packing a gun.
I thought that was symbolically perfect.
Steiger is a very interesting actor, but obviously he needs control because he is so melodramatic in some of the films. But other things like Dr. Zhivago, he was excellent, Dr. Zhivago.
Strong director, but you see, he's much better controlled in film. Gets on the stage and he somehow feels he has to really eat up the scenery. And Corsaro wasn't strong enough to contain him. And after a while, the director sort of feels, oh, it's not worth it. You get a performance, and when you get a really good performance from a good actor, he locks it in, and then he hones it and makes it better and better. And Steiger just wobbles around. He'd come in one night as Olivier, and the next night he'd come in as Marty the Butcher Boy, you know, and it was just too much.
Yeah, that's right. Well, this was a delightful memoir. I read it. Great interest. I almost couldn't put it down. And, of course, the part I like best, because it's my own literary interest, I don't know if they told you. I don't know if you've ever heard my broadcast. Probably you haven't, but it's called BookBeat, and it's a little news report that runs 5 days a week on WCBS, and it also runs on about five other CBS-owned stations across the country. And it's their news. It's news report on books and authors. And,
so I have heard it. It's very well done. It's different. It's a different kind of reaction. I heard it once. I don't get to hear radio much. That's the trouble. But I don't know what it was, but I remember thinking, well, that's a different way to discuss a book.
Well, instead of taking the interview, it would be much easier for me to take this interview that I'm doing with you and turn it around and run it, but I don't. Since I do a news report, I use, it's like a magazine article or a daily newspaper column, and then I take the interview and I take excerpts from it, like quotes, and I integrate them with my own thoughts.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Very well done. There must be a lot of work.
It is. No, it's more work involved, but it also, I can probably, if I talk to, one young writer recently for about an hour and 40 minutes on tape. We just didn't stop talking. Actually, I could throw him a question, and then he would go, his mind just kept working on and on, and he had so many different things to say, so the interview ran very long. And I probably, however, I gave him, I think, three parts on the air, and I probably covered just about everything that we hit in that hour and 40 minutes, because as a news person, you tend to do this. You tend to distill information and then pass
it
on.
Yeah, the best, pull out that which is the most interesting.
At the same time, I'm toying with the idea of asking CBS to allow me to use these interviews in transcript form in some way, because there's more elaboration, there's more meat in the interviews than you can get in a news report.
So, do you keep these? You keep a file?
Oh, I keep my tapes going back to the 70s.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I have them going back. I think one of the first ones I did was with James Jones. A couple of them I didn't save. A couple of them are missing. Like I cannot find the interview I did with John Cheever, which
could
never, ever be replaced. A historical interview that I could never duplicate. But most of the interviews that I've saved with prominent writers, many of them are dead, like Jones and John Gardner and others, I have. And I hope to make better use of them sometime.
That would be a good idea if you could use them as transcript. That would be very good.
Because the elaboration in these interviews has never had another audience. Doesn't do anybody any good sitting in a file cabinet. But also the kind of format that I do allows me to talk with you in an informal way without having to perform. strut.
Because you don't
look
have to
at
stick
the clock.
This on air, right?
That's right.
So verbatim.
If I ask a dumb question, or if I'm redundant, or the subject is, it doesn't really matter because it's not going to make it on the air. I don't have time.
It's perfect. Well, it's like an interview that you would have when researching something for a book or an article, in which you take everything you can get and then decide what you want to use.
Not much different than Hemingway or Doris Day or whatever. But I digressed, I'm afraid. I had said that some of the more interesting aspects of the book to me were your early days as a scout. Is that what you call a scout or a headhunter?
A bounty hunter
for Cosmopolitan. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that a little bit. I know you covered this in the book, and I was quite amused when you went after Ferber and Dorothy Parker and so forth. Tell me how this worked out.
Well, I had been on Air Force Magazine. I wound up there after the Anti-Submarine Command, and then I wound up being head of the bureau in Paris. And a friend of mine, Arthur Gordon, who was the managing editor, had become editor of Cosmopolitan, then a literary magazine before Helen Gurley Brown deflowered it. And he came back after the war along with everybody else, but I had this lovely liaison with a beautiful young coloratura soprano whose picture's in the book. And I stayed on in Paris, and I got discharged there. I had a lot of severance pay, and I had a grand time until it disappeared. The time came to come back to reality, and by then all the jobs were filled. And Arthur said, you know, I've been offering you all these jobs, and I don't have anything. But he took pity on me. He would look so forlorn at this. He said, all I can offer you is, here's a list of 30, 40 writers who once wrote for Cosmopolitan, and they haven't for a long time. And we'll give you your expenses to go see them, wherever they are. And if you can get them to write again, we'll give you $300 a head. And on that list was Ferber and Dorothy Parker, Ernest Hemingway, Faulkner, Steinbeck, everybody. And I started off with the two women because they were right in New York, became good friends with them as it developed. Each of them had a writer's block, which I didn't know. Ferber because she was so desolate over what the Nazis were doing to the Jews and what had happened to the world that she just couldn't write. Parker because she was drinking a lot and simply grieving over Alan Campbell, whom she had been married to but who had gone off to the coast. And in both cases, these women had crises in their lives. And I understood that the famous and the seemingly impregnable all had vulnerable spots. From the very beginning, that was apparent. I even found it with Gable down at OCS. These people all want to talk to you if you can find the area that they are soft in. They don't want you to say, you know, what's your favorite book, or what role did you like the best, or how was Vivian Leigh, that kind of thing they don't want to talk about. But if you're willing to care about a crisis in their life, they want to talk to you. Not many people want to talk to him about that. So in the case of Ferber and Parker, I learned a great deal about writing. You know, Ferber told me something invaluable. I once said to her, you know, you've created these books in which the women are so real, Giant and Cimarron and So Big, which I think was her best book. She won the Pulitzer Prize for it. How do you get so close to the character? She said, I'll tell you something, Hotchner. If you ever want to really find out about women, ask them about their fathers. And it was the best advice I ever got. Because when it came time to doing Sophia or Doris, Candy Bergen, or all of these people, and the going got a little tough, we got onto their fathers. Even though the fathers were inconsequential, or they thought, like Sophia saw her father four times in her life. She was illegitimate, and he was a son of a bitch. He was really a terrible man. He sued her for libel. She wanted to legitimatize her sister's name. He charged her €1 million in order for the sister to be able legally to use his name, although he didn't dispute the fact that they were his children. So when I got to the point of discussing her father, she said, well, that's nonsense. I mean, I've seen him four times, and he's a terrible man. And by the time we were through, she was ready for me to put a foreword on the book that started the most important man in my life was my father. I married him. Ponte was 23 years older. I almost married another man who was. Cary Grant was 30 years older. He was my director, De Sica. Everybody in her life was really a father substitute, which she hadn't really realized. And then she relived for me the moment in the hospital when he was dying, and she came in, and they finally had something in that moment of death that passed between them. It was very touching, and it also was very basic. And the same thing is true of Doris, whose father left her when she was 11 years of age. She never saw him again, really. He married the mother of her best friend. She finally got around to facing the fact that he had had an affair with this mother in the room right next to where she was supposedly asleep. And yet, when we got down to it, she began to describe her emotions. This man really ruled a great deal of her development and what she was looking for in men, and probably accounted for the four rotten husbands she had.
Your early career as a literary bounty hunter was fortuitous for you in a variety of ways, but one of the chief reasons was your meeting with Ernest Hemingway. You've written extensively about Hemingway, of course, in another book, and Hemingway in Choice People tends to go all the way through the book. But why don't you tell my listeners a little bit about how you hooked up with Hemingway and his impact on your life?
Well, again, he was on the list as one of the bounties that was offered to me. And he was the last one I wanted to see because I was in absolute awe of him, and I just didn't want to face going to him and saying, "Mr. Hemingway, why don't you write something for Cosmopolitan magazine?" But by that time, Arthur had an opening on the staff, and he said, "I'll tell you what, I'll trade off. You go down to see Hemingway and do your duty down there, and you can have the job," so, which I did. But I didn't see him. I sent him a note. I said, "You know, Dear Mr. Hemingway, I'm down here on this dumb mission to ask you to write an article on the future of literature for Cosmopolitan magazine. And if you would be good enough to send me a little note that says that's a dumb idea and I can go back with it and show as I can, I'll keep this job." And instead he called me and he said, "Come on, have a drink with me. I mean, it's not so bad to talk about the future of anything." And by the time I had visited down there for about 3 days, he had decided that he would let us have his new novel, Across the River and Into the Trees. And it was really the beginning of the most rewarding friendship I'll ever have. 14 years of seeing each other in various places and participating in what has to be the most unusual life that I will ever run across.
In fact, there's a photograph of you and Hemingway each carrying shotguns, as I recall.
After a duck shoot. In Ketchum. I had never had a gun in my hand before. He taught me to. I think one of the things he really liked was that I was such a greenhorn. It was a young man who had never done anything. I came out of St. Louis from a really poor depression family. So I never really indulged in any of this. Landlocked and money locked and locked in every other way. And more than willing, however, both with interest and some ability to participate in these things. And he loved that. So he took me out on a boat and taught me how to boat my first fish. You know, he didn't call himself Papa for nothing. He really was Papa and loved the role, which he assumed during the Second World War. That's really where he got the nickname, because he was kind of paternal with the troops he came in contact with. He wasn't in the army. He was really a correspondent for Collier's Magazine, but by the time the war was over, he's wearing sidearms and he had his own irregular troops and all the rest of it. So I think it was this business of transferring a kind of a mantle of papa to son. He had three sons, and it hadn't worked out with any of them. I mean, there were a relationship for various reasons. He didn't see much of them, and I think with a kind of a vengeance, he decided that I would be a kind of a son substitute. I tell you all of this in retrospect. I certainly didn't think it then. I didn't think anything then. I just thought that this was just marvelous, that here was this unique and fascinating man allowing me to share his life on these adventures. But
how did it work, because you were both so far flung? How did you hook up with each other over that 14-year period?
Well, I quickly abandoned the life of an editor and embraced the precarious life of a freelancer, and I think that the theme of that runs through the book. That is, the role of the freelancer, the writer who must propel himself by his bootstraps through a career of originating the things he wants to write, and whether you are a novelist like Malamud or Philip Roth, or whether you are an article writer for Playboy magazine, you're really doing the same thing. You are preparing on your own, out of your wits, something that you're going to write that people will want to read. That's really what you're doing. And it often has to come from mysterious forces that you don't understand yourself.
Of course, you're becoming a freelancer was not exactly voluntary.
No, it was economic. You either did or you got yourself a job.
Well, you had an unpleasant ending to your career at Cosmopolitan.
Oh, that's true. Yes, I did. The editor there, Herbert Mays, had come in and supplanted my friend Arthur Gordon, and he was lopping off heads right and left, and at some point he believed that I was trying to usurp his position, which God knows I wasn't. I really wasn't very much interested in it. But after I left there and entered the world of the freelancer, I was able, when Hemingway said, you know, I was doing an article, for example, in The Hague with the Queen. I was seeing an audience with the Queen, you know, ostensibly because they said they had discovered a black tulip. Now, that's a very elusive color. It's never been effectively bred in tulip, dark, dark purple. But as a matter of fact, there's a famous novel by Alexander Dumas, The Black Tulip, and that's the whole thing about it. And there is a reward, really, of $1 million to anybody who can come up with a truly black tulip. So this was the idea that there was a black tulip, so I went there to see if there was. What I really went for was to substantiate or not to substantiate a rumor that there was a soothsayer living in the palace and advising Queen Juliana on how to run the government of Holland.
Now the Rasputin.
Yes, but a female. And there was, as I discovered. But at any rate, there I was up there, and I get a call from Ernest, and he says, "What are you doing? I'm in Venice. When you're through there, come on down. We'll drive along the Riviera." You see, those kind of options were open to me. Or he would call and say, "I'm out in Ketchum, and the pheasant season looks terrific. And why don't you find something to do that'll get you out here or near here, and we'll put you up," and that kind of thing. And so then I would find some assignment or other. On one occasion, I went out there and we hunted, and the priest of a local church asked him whether he would talk to a teenage group in the vestry rooms, and Ernest brooded about this, but eventually he did, and he answered questions of these kids, and afterwards he said, "Did you find that interesting?" And I said, "It was fascinating. I mean, the things they asked you were quite interesting, and I thought your answers were it's too bad that they weren't disseminated beyond that." "Well," he said, "you know, you've got to justify your being here. You might write it up," which I did, and it ran somewhere, and it paid for my having been there. So he was aware that I had to finance myself on this.
Probably the nucleus of your book in some way.
In some ways. Yeah, I used it in Papa Hemingway. Mm-hmm. I don't use it in this book. But I write about him in a different way here.
Did Hemingway at any point help you with your own writing? Does it look at your copy and say, "Hey, this is not the way you should do it"? Or did he give you any kind of guidance from a literary standpoint?
He did when I started to adapt the stories into television plays. Mm-hmm. Then, not specifically, but he spent a lot of time giving me background. For example, I did a short story of his for Playhouse 90, an hour and a half off a short story. It was called The Gambler, the Nun, and the Radio. And there were people in the hospital, and it was impossible to know their backgrounds. They were just in the hospital. So I asked him about these various people, and he told me wonderful background information that he said had been in the original short story, and then he cut it out. He did that very often. he would write about these people and then just take it out and feel that the strength of it remained. So he was useful, but he never in any way participated in my prose writing, just in those plays. But I did a first novel, which I really, honest to God, didn't intend to do as a novel. I was living in Rome and having a fine time and running out of money, which was a common affliction, and decided that what I ought to do is write a short novel for the Saturday Evening Post or Collier's or someplace, which I did, meaning to use it in that market. A friend of mine came through Rome, a mover and shaker, and he said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I've just written this." And he read it, and he said, "Oh, well, you don't want to send it to them. That can be a book." And he gave it to Bennett Cerf, who was then the head of Random House. And to my surprise and trepidation, they decided to publish it as a book, which they did. It was called The Dangerous American. And it was not good. Let me tell you, it was really not good. In the terms of a book, it was not anything that should have been published. Well, I felt that I should let Ernest see this when it was published. And I did. And he reacted strongly to the negative. He said, "You know, you have to take writing more seriously." He said, "Obviously, there are things in here that you write well. But," he said, "you're writing about something that you don't know a damn about. What do you know about the underworld of Venice?" "Nothing. I was writing about stuff I really didn't know about." He was absolutely right. And I learned a great deal about writing from that experience, because I never again attempted to write about anything that I hadn't somehow been involved in. I mean, you have The Man Who Lived at the Ritz there, which was my last novel. And even though that takes place during the German occupation of Paris, I came into Paris 2 weeks after the Germans left. And I was in the Ritz at that time, and I know the city as it was left, and I know the problems, and I did an enormous amount of research while I was writing the Sophia Loren book on the conditions that were in Paris at that time while the Germans were there.
You have been living in Paris in recent years too, haven't you?
Yeah, I was living there then.
Yeah, so you also could retain the flavor of the,
exactly,
of the city.
Exactly.
No matter what period of...
So I learned from Hemingway in that way. I mean, you learn something from everybody you come in contact with.
Well, you mentioned Random House purchasing your first novel, and you had a good relationship with Random House until, I believe, I can't remember the name of the book.
King of the Hill.
King of the Hill, which, of course, was issued subsequently by Simon & Schuster.
By Harper & Row.
I'm sorry. Harper & Row. I did usually do these things off the top of my head. I should have written it down. By Harper & Row, and it came out with very good reviews, but you had some problem with Random House, and... you go into great detail in Choice People about it, but it's such an interesting story. I just wonder if you could capsulize it for me. Because I think there should be some background known on this. You have training, or at least you have training as a lawyer, or at least you have a law degree.
No, I practiced law for about a year and a half or so before I went into the Air Force.
Went to trial on a statutory rape case, too.
Szymanski, accused of... statutory rape of his 14-year-old daughter. That's my first introduction to the law. And it's a capital crime in the state of Missouri, for which, if you're convicted, there's an obligatory visit to the hot seat. So that was my introduction to it. Yes, I had that background in law. What had happened was that while Bennett Cerf was at Random House, it was, for me, a very compatible and perfectly... friendly, that's the word, publishing house. You know, I felt good about the people there, and they sort of cared about what I was writing, and that's what the writer looks for. And when Bennett withdrew, the same editor was the editor on the manuscript that I call King of the Hill, which was an account of a summer of my life when I was 12 years old and living with my family in a flea bag hotel in a terrible section of St. Louis during the Depression. It was written while I was living in Paris in the first person, as I wouldn't have written it when I was of that age. That's what I decided to do with it. Rather than looking back on that time as an adult, I wanted to create sort of the feeling of how I remembered it as a boy. And I turned it in. It was my third book for them, fourth book. three had been published, and they had not suffered any losses, and they'd made a great deal of money on two of them. First reaction from the same editor was, well, it's all right with some changes, and we discussed some that were agreeable and some not, and that was all right. And then, after a couple of weeks, she said, you know, I've decided it'd be better if this book were not written.
That was Nan Talese.
It was Nan Talese. If this book was not written as a 12-year-old boy, but as an adult looking back on that experience. To give you an example of what I'm talking about, it's as if somebody said to J.D. Salinger, Holden Caulfield shouldn't be telling you this story. You should write it and say, Holden Caulfield went so-and-so-and-so-and-so. I said, now, listen, that is not the prerogative of the publishing house. I mean, that is an artistic judgment. I made that clear from the beginning. There were letters to that effect, that that's how it was going to be written. And I certainly am not interested in going back and redoing the book completely in that way. I don't feel I'd have any energy for it. Well, she said, then we have to decide that we won't publish it. I said, okay, that's, to my way of interpreting a contract, perfectly the right of the publisher. Now, they had paid me half of an advance that was due. I took a small advance on that book because I had done well on the book before and I didn't want too much income. So what was involved was $11,500 that had been paid. And my point of view was that I had delivered a manuscript on time, a perfectly okay manuscript, and my risk was the time I had spent, and their risk was the $11,500. Now, the book hadn't gone anywhere at this point. There was a demand for the return of the money, and I said, absolutely not. It went to one publishing house, to Harper & Row. They took it immediately, just the way it was, and it was published to very good reviews. I only received from Harper & Row that half of the advance that was still owing. They did not pay me $25,000. At this point, Random House decided they would sue for the entire $11,500, which they did. They took depositions, and the head of their law firm, which is a very expensive law firm, Horace Manges, called up an attorney who represents me for other things and said, you know, it's ridiculous that Hotchkin doesn't pay this because it's going to cost him several times that in lawyer's fees. Now, to me, that's a real form of blackmail. And I said, well, you tell them I'm going to be my own lawyer, foolish though that may be, which I was. And I had a lot of fun because I was able to resurrect all the old pleadings that I remembered from law school, interrogatories, knowing that every piece of paper I filed would run up their lawyers' bills and the amount of paper they had to file. And we went to trial in Supreme Court of New York before Judge Martin Evans, who luckily is one of the judges who works at a case and studies the law. And at the conclusion of the presentation of their case, I cross-examined their witnesses. It all swung on an interpretation of a clause that's in all contracts, which is invidious, and that is that the writer shall submit to the publisher on time a manuscript that is in form and content satisfactory to the publisher. Now, if that's interpreted absolutely for what it says, that means that at the whim of the publisher, he can decide that he doesn't want the manuscript. Now, there's nothing in the contract, however, that says what happens when that takes place. It doesn't say the writer shall then return his advance to the publisher. That's all it says, that it should be satisfactory to him. My point was, that's okay. It has to be satisfactory. If it isn't, the manuscript falls, but there's nothing there. It's his contract that says I have to give the money back. And in the end, I cross-examined their witnesses. I introduced the reviews of the book, which were highly laudatory. Obviously, the manuscript was more than satisfactory. It was published by the first bookhouse that got it. And if I must say, I made the case so well that without putting a witness on, Random House, with its legal tail between its legs, went into the judge's chambers and ask permission to withdraw the lawsuit, which they did. And that, unfortunately, was my last experience with Random House. I say unfortunately because it's a good house. I just think that at the moment it doesn't have the kind of leadership that is friendly to the kind of writers that once prospered there. And so they've mostly left. And so the editors. And Anne's gone. She's now head of Houghton Mifflin. Alice Mayhew is gone. Many of those people left.
I have a feeling that the issue, because of the settlement, the issue has been left somewhat murky.
It was. And if I could have stayed here, see, I had to come here from Paris and go back again. I knew they would appeal it. And I would have had to hire somebody to write an appellate brief. And if I had persisted in that, Judge Evans would have written a good opinion, but they would have certainly appealed it, and it looked like 2 years of really heavy legal expense and maneuvering and time I would have had to put in, and I just wish I had had the money and the time to let that happen.
What do the contracts read that you signed with Morrow for the last couple of books you've written? Same kind of clause?
Yes, but, that's all right, as long as it doesn't say that I have to return the advance.
Nor will you.
Nor will I.
They know that. They're not going to...
Well, I think there should be mutual risk. The writer risks his time, and the publishing house risks some money. And as long as what you do is in good faith, and you perform it within the time asked of you, then I think you've performed your part of the contract.
I have a feeling, although you've certainly written a lot of celebrity profiles, biographies of people like Doris Day and Lorraine, but I have a feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, that your first love is fiction. I'm wrong?
I think so. I think that fiction gives you great freedom. I think factual fiction is very interesting to do, as in The Man Who Lived at the Ritz. I enjoyed doing Choice People more than any nonfiction book I've done, certainly more than those biographies, because I was able to take nonfiction, take experiences with people, and relate them to my own life, and evaluate it in terms, emotional terms, of what these people meant, who I thought they really were, instead of it being just a profile of somebody, keeping myself out of it. I was part of this experience, and this kind of book is very satisfying to do. It you enjoy it because it forces you to analyze the people and yourself, and somehow you are able to relate what was happening to what was happening in your own life, autobiographical evaluation. And even though what you're doing is spending a couple of weeks with Jimmy Durante having a hilarious time in New York, it stirs up a lot of things that may have been happening to you at that time that relate to what was happening with Jimmy.
I found out, for example, that you claim responsibility for titling A Movable Feast by Hemingway.
That's right, yeah. Mary couldn't find a title, and it was all set to be published, and I remembered this evaluation that he had made of Paris. And so I gave her the title. And in the book... she's written a dedication page in which she says, you know, for much of this, thanks to you. That evaporated with the publication of Papa Hemingway because she sued to have it stopped. But that didn't succeed in any way.
Well, I certainly enjoyed reading this and finding out more about you. And I did want to ask you one other thing about the plays. You produced you had written a number of plays that were performed on CBS. I guess these were some of the live things a long
Playhouse
time ago.
Playhouse 90. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about that period in your career.
Oh, that was so exciting. I began by doing adaptations of Hemingway short stories, and I only began doing that because Ernest said he didn't want, if I would just handle it, I was in New York, and he didn't want these people all coming down there to Havana and seeking him out and trying to talk him into doing things, because he said he didn't know who was going to do it, or whether it should be done. And so just by a kind of dedication to his well-being, because he was being harassed at that point, I began doing these. The first was The Battler, which is a very, very short story of his that I turned into an hour television play. James Dean was to be the lead of it, live television. he was killed 2 weeks before the rehearsals, and we had a relatively unknown actor in the part of young Nick Adams. So out of desperation, Arthur Penn, who was the director, decided to put him in the lead, and that was Paul Newman. And that was his first big part, and he went right from there to Somebody Up There Likes Me and became a star. We did For Whom the Bell Tolls in a big and costly CBS production that cost a lot of people their heads.
That was interesting. That had a taped portion of it, or a film portion in the middle.
Yeah, that, I don't think there's ever been anything like that before.
Well, what happened?
Well, because Paramount owned the rights to For Whom the Bell Tolls. It was a little murky as to whether or not it pertained also to television. But since we were putting it on tape, they were rattling their swords and making a claim that tape and film were first cousins and that they had the right to the tape also. So CBS wanted to try to spring the right so there wouldn't be anything nasty about the aftermath of it. So they made a deal with Paramount, and they said, okay, you allow us to tape this, and then we'll do one key scene that we won't put on tape right out of the middle of this thing. We'll do it live. We'll interrupt the taping and do this one live scene. Therefore, we can never use this again. See, they wanted a guarantee that there would just be one time on the CBS network. So what happened was that the famous scene in the sleeping bag between Robert Jordan and Maria, played by Maria Schell and Jason Robards, took place in the middle of the telecast. So the tape rolled, and when it got to about 1 hour, it suddenly cut to a studio where live they performed this scene, and then it went back to the tape. And since there was a break, they were never able to use the finished product.
Anybody ever think of taping that scene later? I mean, were there guards there to make sure it wasn't done? Or
I think the
kinescopes at all of it.
Well, if you put a kinescope in, the quality would be so bad it would be
so that broadcast in effect is gone forever.
It's gone forever. Yeah. It's too bad. It was a memorable broadcast and a wonderful cast. Yeah. And a hell of a show.
And you're still writing plays.
Still writing plays. I'm doing with Anthony Quinn now. In Choice People, I write about the fact that for 18 years now, Tony's been trying to do Papa Hemingway, first as a movie, and that didn't work, then as a musical, which I said, Tony, I have no part of. I said, you're going to sing and dance as Hemingway? He said, if I had brought you the idea of doing Evita Perón is a musical. I said, okay. So he tried for a year with that, and that didn't work. But now I've done a script, and he's done a lot of readings of it. And I've just come from his apartment where he had another reading of it. And it looks like he'll leave Zorba in the end of June, and that we'll do it next fall.
Okay.
Just where, I don't know, but we'll do it.
Are you still living in Paris?
No, I'm back here now. I have a little place in New York and a big place in Connecticut. I go back and forth.
So it looks like freelancing has paid off.
Well, like Ernest used to say, so far my luck, she is running good.
Listen, A. Hotchner, thank you very much. I certainly enjoyed Choice People and all the greats, near greats and ingrates you have known, and thank you for coming in and talking to me.